Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the leadership fight at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Former Congressman Barney Frank weighs in.
This is a man who's one of the busiest people in Washington. He's the budget director. He's supposed to be keeping the government running. So he's going to run this important agency, what, on his lunch hour?
Plus, Anthony Scaramucci threatens students at Tufts University with a lawsuit. He says a student newspaper defamed him. The paper's editor stands by their work.
So with any opinion piece, our criteria is going to be, number one, are all the facts in this op-ed correct?
And how advances in digital fabrication will mean soon we'll be able to make almost anything.
The idea of personal fabrication isn't to make what you can buy at Walmart, but it's to make what you can't buy at Walmart. You can mass produce things where everybody wants the same thing. It's to make things where people want different things.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just before 8 o'clock this morning, a spokesman for White House Budget Chief Mick Mulvaney tweeted that Mulvaney was hard at work in his post as acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And according to reports, he brought donuts. Now, just a couple of minutes later, Leandra English sent out an email to the CFPB's 1,600 employees, and she signed her email acting director because she was appointed on Friday by the agency's former head, Richard Cordray, on the day he resigned. So are you confused yet? I mean, I was a little bit. So imagine how the Bureau's employees feel, because minutes later, Mulvaney sent out another email telling folks to disregard any instructions you receive from Miss English. All this while a U.S. District Court has taken up a lawsuit filed by English asking for a temporary restraining order to stop President Trump from appointing Mick Mulvaney as acting director. Now, Mulvaney has long been a critic of the Bureau. He's called it a joke and a sick one at that in the past. Now, I know this is a lot to take in, but stay with me because the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is perhaps one of the most powerful banking industry regulators out there. It was conceived by Elizabeth Warren before she became senator, and the agency has returned almost $12 billion to consumers since its creation in 2010 via the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act. Now, it's supposed to be relatively independent and insulated from political pressures, which, of course, is exactly the opposite of what's happening right now to the Bureau. Well, Congressman Barney Frank joined us in the last hour from New York City. Of course, he's the Frank in Dodd-Frank. And he says that he thinks this impasse over leadership at the Bureau is having a negative effect at the CFPB.
And unfortunately, until we can get a court resolution, and hopefully the right one, will mean a substantial reduction in consumer protection in the area of financial activity. We're betting against a stalemate, but my view is that there'll be a certain momentum to the administration in power, and you have a man who's been designated by the president to run this agency, I think inappropriately, on both substantive and procedural grounds, but he may prevail, who doesn't believe in the agency and will shut it down. So what this means is that consumer protection, which got a great boost in the legislation we passed and has profited from a very well-run agency, is going to be in limbo for some time.
Mm. You know, as you know, both the Department of Justice and even the general counsel at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau point to the Vacancies Reform Act of 1998 and say that that gives the president authority to fill the position of director once it became vacant last week.
Yeah, I think that's wrong. I was there when we wrote the law.
Yeah.
And there were two points here. First of all, the law we wrote is later than the Vacancies Act. The Vacancies Act was in effect. Apparently, their position is that when we wrote some specific language regarding this this agency, we were making up, we were just wasting our time. If the Vacancy Act was going to govern, we wouldn't have bothered to write that. In fact, it is generally the rule that when there's law on the books and you then write a later law, that later law affects the changes. Secondly, the purpose of what we were doing was to give this agency some protection. It's not a normal federal agency that goes out and does affirmative and direct things. It's a protection for consumers against abuse by some of the most powerful interests in the country. And given that, we deliberately set out to give it some insulation from political heat. And this acting director provision is a part of that.
Yeah. So just let me ask you in a little bit more detail, because I'm just looking at, for example, what General Counsel Mary McLeod wrote on November 25th, the day after Richard Cordray resigned as director of CFPB. And, you know, what she says mirrors the DOJ pretty closely, as you know. You know, she says the Vacancies Reform Act is not exclusive, but it doesn't mean that it's unavailable. And so she's directing folks at the Bureau to understand that, she says, Director Mulvaney is the acting director of the CFPB.
Well, I understand that. That's what I was addressing. I think she's wrong.
Yeah.
Look, it's not as clear as it could be. I am surprised at the interpretation that says the earlier statute somehow. Well, I just heard a conservative who was against the existence of the agency, and that's why they want Mulvaney in there, because he will trash it, say, well, it gave the president an option. There's nothing in the law that says that. The law specifically says this is what should happen. I don't know why the general counsel interpretation did. There is a strong tradition in American legal interpretation that the president should always be given more power. I don't think that's always served us well. But in any case, I think she's wrong, and I don't understand how a law that was in existence when we wrote a later law means that we were just not serious when we wrote that law.
Yeah. Now, just so that I understand clearly, Congressman Frank, when you say that the law says this is what should happen, is that the outgoing director naming the acting director?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Because there are some folks out there who say that former Director Cordray caused this problem by naming an acting director. I mean, he knew that the president had someone in mind.
The law calls for there to be an acting director. In their mind, Cordray caused the problem. I don't care why didn't the president cause it by naming Mulvaney. By the way, look how that looks. This is a man who's one of the busiest people in Washington. He's the budget director. He's supposed to be keeping the government running. So he's going to run this important agency, what, on his lunch hour? And in fact, he doesn't believe the agency should exist. This is not a narrow technical legal dispute. This is about substance. This is an effort by the right wing that does not like the notion of consumer protection, that wants to give Wells Fargo and other financial institutions free rein and not have them bothered by this consumer protection to get rid of it. And yeah, what Richard Cordray was trying to do was to protect this agency, but he was acting in accordance with the statute that he was governed by. Now, you could argue that the earlier statute somehow meant that the later statute didn't have any effect. I think that's an odd interpretation. But say he was causing trouble by following the statute. And most importantly, what he was trying to do was to keep alive active and vigorous consumer protection against a president who, having run as someone who was going to help the average citizen, has, of course, been doing everything he can to undermine the rights of the average citizen against the big interests.
Yeah. You know, to your point, Congressman Frank, I mean, as you said, there is a court case now that was filed last night, so this will get decided in the courts one way or the other. I just wonder if the longer-term concern is that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has already been highly politicized, and this just makes that problem that much worse.
By that, who's made it more politicized?
Well, not the Bureau itself.
Cordray should give up. I am just astonished by that. In the first place, what made it highly politicized? You know, the conservatives, the people who try to attack this agency, raise these issues about how it's been irresponsible, et cetera. Can you give me one example of anything the Bureau has done in its official program that contributed to that? I can't think of any. And I do know that its critics don't have any. So what has the Bureau done that has politicized this issue?
Well, no, I wasn't mentioning that the Bureau itself had done anything to politicize the issue,
well,
but
it's been politicized. Healthcare has been politicized. In other words, it is true. When you have people who don't like what was done during the Obama years, didn't like healthcare, didn't like consumer protection, didn't like financial regulation elsewhere, when you have people who don't like it and they attack it, I suppose it is true. It would be less divisive if you just gave in. Yeah. But it would have a terrible result. So no, I wouldn't characterize politicizing it as when you're trying to defend the agency that was existed.
Ultimately, though, are you concerned that no matter how this current problem plays out, that President Trump will get to name a new director. And if I remember correctly, in the statute, that only requires a simple majority for Senate confirmation.
Yes, then, of course I'm concerned. That's why I didn't want him to be president. And we all understood that if whoever was the president would get to make the appointment. But confirmation in this case, given that even that it has to be a majority, it means something. There are, unlike other things that the president was against, this is a pretty popular thing in the country. You notice they haven't tried to change it legislatively. Going after Wells Fargo when it went and cheated people that way, that's a popular thing. Getting money back from people who've been overcharged by their credit card companies, that's also a popular thing. Defending students who have loans, graduated students who are being unfairly pressed to pay back more than they should, those are all popular. So the point is this. If President Trump were to appoint someone in the future, as he will have the right to do, who is as opposed to the whole notion of consumer protection as Mr. Mulvaney, I don't think that person would be confirmed. I think the confirmation process will be a check. Yes, there are only 48 Democrats, but Senator Collins from Maine is a Republican who voted for this bill. I don't think she will vote to confirm someone who will trash it. Senator Corker, well, he's retiring, but Senator Corker, Republican senator, was the man who came up with this notion of this independent agency under the Federal Reserve, not subject to appropriation. So, yes, the president will have an appointment, but I think in this case, even getting 51 votes will be something of a check. It'll be a more conservative appointee than I would have made or that President Obama made, but it will not be easy for him to get someone confirmed who is as opposed to the whole notion of the agency as Mr. Mulvaney.
Well, that's former Congressman Barney Frank. Congressman, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We spoke with the congressman a little earlier today. Well, let's get a different view now. This is from Noah Feldman. He's a professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School. Professor Feldman, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What's your take on what you just heard Congressman Frank say?
You know, I believe that lawsuits against the president for abuse of executive power are very serious things, and they should be saved for when they're really needed. And unfortunately, in this administration, we've needed them a lot because President Trump has overreached many times. This, in contrast, to my mind, is a wasted opportunity. It's a waste to go to the courts over this. First of all, it's largely symbolic because everyone admits that the president has the right to name the actual director, who will then be confirmed by the Senate. Convinces the world and the courts that the Democrats are using partisan maneuvering in the courts rather than waiting for a serious constitutional challenge. And in my view, it would have been much better if Richard Cordray had not used a last-minute maneuver to appoint Leandra English, and much better if she had not brought suit.
Okay, so let's dig into this a little bit, because I'm looking here right now at the Dodd-Frank Act, and the language is very simple, but it says, Deputy Director, there is established the position of Deputy Director who shall A, be appointed by the Director, and B, serve as Acting Director in the absence or unavailability of the Director.
Right. So this is the very definition of a loophole. There was no Deputy Director as of Friday morning when Richard Cordray reached his last day in office. There was someone who was called the Acting Deputy Director. As his last official act, essentially, the outgoing director named his chief of staff, who had not been the deputy director, as deputy director of the agency, so that she would then become acting director. So he was acting within the language of the statute, for sure, but that's exactly what a loophole is. It's when you take advantage of something written into the statute that wasn't anticipated. And it certainly wasn't anticipated that on his last day in office, the director would leave behind someone who would become acting director. It's much more natural to expect the president, who will be appointing the actual director, to make the appointment of the acting director.
But forgive me, I'm gonna put my toe in the water in debating you a tiny bit here.
And by all means,
with full acknowledgement that I am not a constitutional law scholar. But
that's no problem. But
one wonders, and of course only Richard Cordray can know this because he's the one who made this decision last Friday, but perhaps he was doing it because he was anticipating why leave a vacuum in the office of the director for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau while a new appointee is awaited to be, you know, nominated and confirmed by the Senate. Why not do what the statute says? Doesn't matter when, even if it's on his last day of the job, and appoint an acting director.
There would have been no vacuum because, as we see, the president was eager and willing to appoint his own acting director. The point here is that what Cordray was trying to do, by all possible observation, is create exactly this kerfuffle, this fight. He wanted a fight with the president. And, you know, I've got nothing against Democrats fighting with the president or anyone fighting with the president over the Constitution. But you have to pick your spots. You have to pick fights that actually matter, especially in this presidency where the president has behaved so outrageously with respect to executive power on all kinds of things, from sanctuary cities to the Muslim ban. This is a president who the courts need to be checking. And so it's just not a time to play games with executive power. And the honest truth is that everyone who studies this topic of presidential appointments understands that even for independent agencies, whoever happens to be president when the job comes open gets to make the pick. That's why Obama picked Cordray, and it's why Trump will pick someone with a different view. That's just the way the principle is supposed to work. Otherwise, the public never has a say in who gets to run these agencies. We had an election. I don't like the outcome of the election, but the election happened. The president is now the president, and the president therefore gets to make appointments to executive branch agencies when there's a vacancy. It's truly as simple as that.
But isn't there also a loophole in the reasoning that the Department of Justice and the General Counsel at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau itself are offering? Because I'm looking here and they're saying, you know, earlier with Congressman Frank, I was talking about the Vacancies Reform Act,
yes,
which the president is leaning on, saying that's what gives him the right to put Mick Mulvaney in the office right now. And the DOJ is saying, you know, that the Vacancies Reform Act is not exclusive, but that does not mean it is unavailable. Also kind of a loophole, right?
Totally. I completely agree with you. This is a classic case of two very complicated, arcane statutory interpretations butting heads. And a court might decide that, although the court might also just sit on this case until the president nominates and there is confirmed a director, in which case the court will never have to decide it. And courts usually like to avoid making controversial decisions, so we may never even get a decision in this case. My point, though, is that quite apart from the deep inside baseball of which interpretation of the relationship between these two statutes is correct, is a deeper, more fundamental constitutional question, and that is, who gets to name the heads of agencies? And the short answer to that is, it's the president, because these agencies are part of the executive branch. And that's true even for so-called independent agencies like the CFPB, which have some insulation, not because the president doesn't get to appoint, because he does, but just because the president can only fire for a good reason.
Hmm. Final question to you, and this is via a tweet that was sent out by Lawrence Tribe, your colleague there at Harvard Law School.
Mm-hmm.
He says, this is in his tweet, he says, "My usually reliable colleague, Noah Feldman, has this one totally wrong. He says you're ignoring clear and constitutionally unquestionable statutory law to make this a dispute over Cordray's motives and about nebulous generalities." And I just wondered what your response to that is.
Well, you know, Professor Tribe is a great constitutional law scholar, and he taught me that the Constitution is not a bunch of nebulous generalities, but a bunch of core values. And one of those core values, maybe the central core value, is that we the people get to determine who governs us. And in this instance, we the people, for better or worse, chose President Trump. And so he gets to make this appointment. That is a straightforward constitutional principle. It's not nebulous. It's obvious. What's nebulous is the statutory interpretation. And my much-esteemed colleague, Professor Tribe, has got it wrong here.
Well, that's Noah Feldman, professor of constitutional law at Harvard Law School. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Philip. Take care.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, this month, the Tufts Daily, the student newspaper at Tufts University, published two opinion pieces that criticized Anthony Scaramucci. Now, Scaramucci's a Tufts alum, and he's a member of the advisory board of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. And yes, he's also probably best known for his 10-day stint as White House communications director before he got let go by President Trump. Now, Scaramucci is, of course, a controversial person. Camilo Caballero, the Tufts student writer, characterized him as, quote, unethical and a man who, quote, sold his soul in contradiction to his own purported beliefs. In response, Anthony Scaramucci's attorney sent a letter to the Tufts Daily threatening to sue for defamation, and he demanded the student newspaper retract those statements, and issue an apology. Well, Tufts University, in response to that, postponed a scheduled event with Scaramucci that was supposed to take place tonight until, quote, these pending legal matters are resolved. Now, we reached out both to Tufts and to Scaramucci. They declined our interview request, so let's turn to Barton Carter. He's a professor of communications and law at Boston University. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
I'm glad to have you because we kind of wanted to find out where is the line when it comes to things like student newspapers or media in general between expressions of opinion and defamation. How do we define defamation to begin with?
Well, first of all, defamation is basically a factual allegation, a false factual allegation that is injurious to reputation.
Okay. And so there has to be fact behind it. And when there's a question about whether or not things are fact-based, how do you resolve that?
Well, that's not always that easy. At one time, the courts, in fact, were treating a real dividing line between fact and opinion, and each court had its own definition of when something was fact or opinion. That sort of subsided, but now it's more a general just look at it. I hate to say it, in some ways it's almost I know it when I see it, but perhaps a good line is it provably false?
Okay. Well, so in the letter that Anthony Scaramucci's lawyers sent to the Tufts Daily, they claimed that his business was already being harmed by the existence of these op-eds from the student newspaper.
Well, that may be. That would go to damages and possibly showing that it had a defamatory meaning, but you still have to get through several other areas. One, you have to prove that there were actual factual allegations. In addition, because he's a public figure, he has to show that they either knew the statements were false or that they had serious doubts about the statements at the time they were made. And he has to prove that by clear and convincing evidence, which is actually a higher standard than a typical civil suit.
So how hard is it to prove that then?
Very.
Okay.
Which is why various politicians who tend to sometimes take, shall we say, umbrage at what's talked about have complained bitterly about this so-called Sullivan rule. It comes from Times v. Sullivan originally. And that goes back to Billy Bulger. And most recently, you know, Donald Trump. President Trump was saying how they needed to change the law because it is very, very difficult to win that kind of case.
Right. You know, we spoke with another attorney with expertise in defamation lawsuits a little earlier today, and that attorney suggested to us that the Tufts student newspaper may be able to argue if this does end up in court. We should be clear. Scaramucci is threatening a lawsuit. He hasn't filed anything yet. He's threatening.
It's a lot easier to threaten.
Yes, exactly. But if this ended up in court, the Tufts student newspaper might be able to claim that Anthony Scaramucci's reputation is libel-proof because it's already been so badly damaged by publicity surrounding, you know, everything from his expletive-laden New Yorker interview to his 10-day stint as White House communications director. Does that seem to – could that hold water?
Yeah, actually, it could. I mean, one final aspect is to recover anything, you've got to show damages. So the question is, how much was his reputation harmed? And when you say somebody's libel-proof, what you're essentially saying is their reputation is already so bad that you really couldn't harm it anymore.
Now, we should note that this whole controversy at Tufts with Anthony Scaramucci comes amid a push or a petition to remove him from the Fletcher School Advisory Board. I mean, do you think that has anything to do with this, or is that sort of a separate and apart from the issues that Scaramucci's lawyers are bringing up?
Well, I think it may have something to do with his motivation. I mean, normally, in fact, an article like this would be better ignored than having threats and so on. I mean, how many people were aware of that op-ed piece prior to his threatening to sue?
Probably far fewer than are now, right?
Yeah, I mean, he has made it a much bigger story. And normally, in defamation, that's not generally what you want. So there has to be some motivation. Now, sometimes it's people just get angry, and even if their lawyers were to tell them, you don't have a real case here, you can't really win, they just say, well, they said this about me, I've got to do it, you know. Emotion overrules logic in some cases.
Yeah. Well, you know, as we mentioned, we did reach out to Tufts University with an interview request, and they declined, but they did send us a statement, and the statement says, "We're disappointed that Mr. Scaramucci has taken this action. The university has been working to facilitate a conversation that had been scheduled for Monday evening between Fletcher School students and Mr. Scaramucci about his background experience and the petition calling for his removal from the Board of Advisors. In light of recent developments, we are postponing the event until these pending legal matters are solved." Now, Barton Carter, you're a professor of communications and law. Do you think Tufts made the right move in canceling the appearance, or should they have gone forward and let Anthony Scaramucci have his say, and students likewise have their say to him?
Well, I think often when somebody's threatening to sue you, you figure there's probably not a reasonable side conversation to take place. I mean, it's almost as though he's basically trying to intimidate as opposed to discuss. Mm. You know, if he just wanted to have the conversation, he could certainly have done so. And he sort of triggered this by, you know, threatening lawsuits.
So what's your message? What's the teachable moment here for young journalists who might be wondering whether or not they should write strongly worded op-eds about any politician?
Well, I guess the answer is, if you're going to be a real journalist, sometimes, you know, you have to expect these things to happen. You know, the whole point of these protections and defamation is to limit what they say chilling effect on reporting and discussion. So if any time somebody threatens, you decide, well, I can't publish anything, then effectively they've succeeded. They have silenced you. And, you know, this is unfortunately part of a problem today. It's a balance between discussion of public affairs protected by the First Amendment and a state's right to protect the reputation of its citizens. And the Supreme Court has said that the First Amendment interest is a very strong one, which is why it's so difficult for a public official or public figure to win a suit of this type.
Right. Well, Barton Carter is a professor of communications and law at Boston University. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
To something entirely different. Is it a boy or a girl? Well, every expectant parent gets that question at some point in time. And it's also the crux of a relatively new social phenomenon called the gender reveal party, at which, true to its name, the gender of an expected baby is dramatically revealed. Now, it sounds like a fun party, but it's also raising some questions. And with us to discuss those questions is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, Megna.
Okay, so since we're talking newborns or infants, let me have another little, oh my God, this has been a long day.
Clearly.
we get down to my ABCs, Carrie.
Let's do that. Did you want to ask me what these parties are like?
That's the question.
Yes.
I've never been to a gender reveal party. What's it like?
So, well, if you've never been to one and you've never watched one, you've missed about 500,000 literally videos on YouTube, because there's something like 600,000 videos if you search for gender reveal on YouTube. And these parties are, you know, some of them are quite elaborate. They have cupcakes or balloons or smoke. They're kind of made for Pinterest, you know. And the whole point of the thing is the pink versus the blue. Like, they all lead up to this dramatic denouement, which is when the guests and usually the parents too find out the sex of the baby that they're expecting, because inside the cake or the balloons that come out of a box or the smoke that comes out are either pink or blue.
Okay, it sounds very exciting, but also very binary.
Very, very binary, yes. About as binary as you can get. And you know, at a time when society is moving away from binary gender norms. So we've just had a post on Common Health by reporter Chelsea Conaboy that features a doctor who specializes in infants whose sex at birth is unclear, so their anatomy is atypical or ambiguous. Uh-huh. And this doctor writes in the journal Pediatrics that, of course, these gender reveal parties, they seem fun-filled and innocent.
But I hear a but coming here. So
yes.
Maybe we should ask, why is sex or gender so important?
Bingo, right. And this doctor, Lena Nahata, is at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. But she trained here at Harvard, and she led the program here on differences in sex development at Children's. So she writes, quote, and I'm quoting, "Are these traditions truly harmless? So by celebrating this single fact several months before an infant's birth, are we risking committing ourselves and others to a particular vision and a set of stereotypes that are potentially harmful? So like, what are the expectations that are being created for this infant just based on sex and implied gender? And what are the implications if and when those expectations are not fulfilled?"
Okay, well, I'm going to say I think those expectations are already there no matter what, but I'm going to, we'll
give you that.
We'll come back to that. In a second, because I just want to see if I understand what you're saying correctly, that Dr. Nahata is saying that the central concern she has is that putting a heavy emphasis on a future child's sex could carry with it some, I don't want to call it baggage, but consequences,
well, stereotypes, right?
Yeah.
Yes. And,
exactly.
And it's just this emphasis on gender. And of course, Dr. Nahata has a particular vantage point because she sees how this can play out when an infant's sex is unclear. And that's not as unusual as you might think. It's about one in every 5,000 births.
Okay, and in those cases, what's usually done then?
Well, so she writes that the approach to these decisions around which gender a baby is assigned and what should be done medically, these decisions have evolved. And now it's really a nice sort of shared decision-making model with the parents and the medical team, equal partners, which sounds a lot better than, you know, the stories you hear about the old days when the doctors were much more high-handed. But even so, you can imagine that these are often not easy decisions to make. And the really hard part is that the child is a baby and they can't help you decide.
Right. And then especially in these cases, wouldn't it be better if we could just wait until the child is old enough to tell their parents or their doctor what their gender is.
Right, which some say could be as early as 2 or 3, but you can't wait, right? And Dr. Nahata even asks this in her piece, like in situations where it's not clear what the right gender would be, can't we wait? But of course, that brings you back to whether you can wait socially, and that brings us back to the gender reveal party as a cultural institution, because if you're attributing masses of importance to a child's sex or gender, then maybe you can't wait. Right?
This seems like a tall order. I mean, she's calling for a cultural de-emphasis on a baby's gender.
Yeah, and I know it goes against the grain, doesn't it? It goes against, I mean, gender is one of the few things, or sex, sorry, is one of the few things you can know about a baby in advance. But she has a lot of allies in this, judging by the social media response to this post on Common Health. My favorite one was from a commenter who said, well, instead of cutting into the cake and finding out that the inside is blue or pink, why don't you just fill the cake with rubber green spiders and just mess with everybody's head?
Okay. Okay, Carrie, so here I go. I'm going to take a deep breath here.
Okay,
because I can see what she's saying in the cases that Dr. Nahata deals with. And, and for a lot of people who don't care what the gender of their child is, fine.
Right, just don't do the party.
But for some people, it's an exciting thing. It's a big deal. And we're just talking about like one innocent little gender reveal party, okay? Like what I'm saying is it really that big of a deal? And maybe it's my current mood, but the current mood I'm in is why do we have to add yet another thing that we're criticizing new or soon to be parents for even before their child is born?
Right. That's so legit. And I also think it's so deeply personal, right? Like what if you've always dreamed of having a child of a certain sex? But I also think that the message that it is okay to take away here is really beware of having specific expectations about how or who your child will be, because destiny and he really loves messing with those expectations,
totally
right? Yes. Yeah. And also, I think, you know, questioning the gender reveal party is probably okay because it makes us stop and think, well, what am I thinking about gender and sex and does it make sense?
Okay. I'm not going to let this one go, though, Carrie.
Okay.
Because what difference does it make when a parent decides to reveal or discover what their child's gender is? Because if really the concern is like, oh, all of a sudden then stereotypes about boys and girls are going to be rushing in, those stereotypes are there. They exist in the culture anyway. So it doesn't matter if a parent talks about a child's gender at 6 months before or, you know, in the second trimester or after a child's birth. It doesn't matter.
Right. The stereotypes exist.
They will still be there. Yeah.
Yes. But arguably, I think you could argue, being devil's advocate here, that if you set up a whole party for the dramatic reveal of what a child's sex is going to be, doesn't that impute just a whole lot of importance to which sex they end up being?
I mean, yes, but we impute a lot of importance to all sorts of things about newborns that we have no control over, like you were saying earlier. So,
that's true.
Okay.
That's true.
All right, so I'm still... I have no opinion on this. I'm just saying.
If you ever want to have a gender reveal party, Meghna, that's okay.
If I do?
Yes.
I'm done.
We'll let that one go.
I had two chances at it. Passed both times. Carrie Goldberg, host of WBR's Common Health Blog. Wow, what a day. Thank you so much, Carrie. We'll be back on Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Many of us have long awaited our chance to have our very own Star Trek replicator.
I believe it's a molecular synthesizer of some kind, similar to a protein resequencer, but far more advanced. To water, cold. I saw a similar device in a Tarkalian vessel. It was capable of replicating almost any inanimate object.
If we had one of these in engineering, we could make all the spare parts we need.
That's a scene from Star Trek Enterprise. But a new book by the Gershenfeld brothers is taking a serious look at the promises and consequences of a world where anyone can turn data into things and things into data, as they write. And they call this future, where anyone can make almost anything, the third digital revolution after communication and computing. The book is called Designing Reality, How to Survive and Thrive in the Third Digital Revolution. And we're joined now in the studio by the Gershenfeld brothers. First of all, Neil Gershenfeld, he's the director of the Center for Bits and Atoms at MIT. He's known for his global network of fab labs, those makerspaces all over the world with tools like 3D printers for community use. Neil Gershenfeld, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Joel Kutcher Gershenfeld. He's a professor at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University and past president of the Labor and Employment Relations Association. Welcome to you as well.
And I should note,
indeed,
we spiritually brought our brother Alan, who's here in spirit.
Exactly. And he's co-founder and president of Eline Media, right?
Right.
Okay.
He developed the biggest video game studio,
yeah,
and then left to do games for education and social change.
So you guys are like the dream team then in thinking about all aspects of what you're calling this third digital revolution.
Yeah, you could think of Neil being science, me being social science, and Alan being the humanities.
Okay. So first of all, let's just get some lay a foundation here. How close do you think we are to this third digital revolution, and will it look like a Star Trek replicator?
Oh, I'd say we're as close as it started, depending on how you counted, 10 years ago in 1952 or 4 billion years ago. But it's very much present today.
Wow.
And so the book is a bold prediction about the present. The best way to understand that is the digital revolution in communication and computation followed what's called Moore's Law, this amazing, yeah, projection. He based it on Gordon Moore, founder of Intel, based it on five data points of the number of transistors on a chip. And on a linear graph, it's just a few points. But if you take the logarithm, which measures doubling, they line up. And he said, what if it kept going for a decade, mm-hmm, and it went for 50 years?
Yeah.
The heart of this book is digital fabrication. If you make the same graph, we're about 10 years into it. So we're further than Moore's Law in being able to make that prediction. So
already,
it's here today. It's just not uniformly distributed.
Okay. So tell me more then about how, once we get more uniform distribution, how is it going to look? How will it change our lives?
So if you have a makerspace or a fab lab in your community, you're already experiencing people collaborating to design and make things. There's about 1,200 fab labs in the world and a similar number of makerspaces. So they're out there and people are seeing it if they have direct contact. If not, it seems abstract or distant. But as Neil says, the doubling of fab labs and the doubling of the capability of the technology is increasing. And the question that we're asking is, what happens to society if this continues? With the first two digital revolutions, we fell short on things like access, inclusion, and all the weaponized social media.
Right.
And so now we're saying, with the third time around, maybe we can get it right early on.
Well, so this is really important, and forgive me for going back to a Star Trek analogy here, because I just feel it's something I can see in my head here. But I think we tend to do this with technological revolutions, right? At first there's this utopian rush of all that is possible, and even on Star Trek, like. Really, when I think of a replicator, I just think of Captain Picard making his Earl Grey tea. I don't also think at the same time that exact same machine allows, because they never show it, someone to replicate a weapon instantaneously. We don't think of the potential downsides.
Yeah, so I think it would help to understand when I say it's here today is like there was originally the first single mainframe, and then there were maybe 1,000 mini computers, and then 1 million hobbyist computers, and then 1 billion smartphones, and then 1 trillion Internet of Things. So think about how computing went through those stages. You could already see all of that at the 1,000 stage. It got faster, better, cheaper, but mm-hmm. fundamentally really didn't change. In the same way, in the book, we explain how to go from one fab lab to 1,000 to 1 million to 1 billion to 1 trillion. And so my lab is on the hook to deliver the replicator as a research project, but the internet wasn't invented after the iPhone. It was decades before, and that's the point. You can do it all today. And so the questions Joel's raising about access, literacy, education, what is work, what is money, they're really here today, but we don't have to wait 50 years to figure out we got it wrong.
Okay, so your concern isn't so much about the potential uses of the technology itself, but what you were talking about earlier, who is and who doesn't get to use it in the coming years.
So, of course, we need to mitigate harm with any technology. And the idea of bad people doing bad things with technology is always a concern. But even before we get to those issues or concurrent with those issues are even more basic questions of not having a digital divide get even worse if it's tied to the ability to make things. What's at stake here is literally people owning the means of production, communities able to break global supply chains and make more of what they need locally in a way that can transform communities. And it can be good and bad depending on the choices we make now.
And if I could pick up on that, sort of the defining battles right now of this era revolve around nationalism versus globalism, sort of roughly. And underneath that is inequality, unemployment, all of those issues. To a really great extent, that whole spectrum is a false dichotomy that's sort of missing the point. It's assuming, do we bring back the old jobs or do we create new jobs? But rather than getting a job to get money to then buy something made far away, if you can create what you consume, mm-hmm. it really changes what is work and what is money. And so when I'm at gatherings of like captains of industry and heads of state, they're all sort of depressed because nothing's working.
Right.
When you're in these communities sort of inventing this third digital revolution, they're excited because they're really changing notions of sustainability and empowerment of community.
Of sustainability? But okay.
Because rather than... for example, a colleague became the city architect of Barcelona. Great design sense there, 50% youth unemployment. Whole generation can't leave home and work traditionally. But products come in made far away and trash trucks go to trash dumps. So he considers the city a product to trash conversion device.
I see. Yeah.
What they want to do is have data come and go, but the atoms stay. So they're filling the city with the means of digital fabrication as part of urban infrastructure so that if you live there, you can produce what you consume as part of the sustainability, the viability of the city.
When you sort of put it in those terms, I can see how it could be create a more sustainable future. But perhaps I'm just a bit cynic about human nature. I also think that if I'm able to create anything I want with relative ease, I'm going to overcreate and overconsume.
So that's really what brought Alan and I into the book. Neil is a technology leader and is on this 50-year journey to the Star Trek replicator. Alan and I have...
What Joel didn't say is Neil is slightly misguided and needs some mid-course correction.
We call him a techno-optimist.
Yeah.
We decided that in many respects, we believe Neil is right, that the technology path is unfolding, but we didn't trust Neil alone to get it right. And so in a sense, Alan, with his focus on humanist issues around his work is with Games for Change, but it's all about social change. My work is similarly, but coming at it from the point of view of governance and institutions and society. We're basically saying that we have the chance to take into account, as you say, the dark side of human nature and build those assumptions into the way we interact with the technology now.
Yeah. So let me ask you, because you mentioned something earlier that I didn't dig into deeply enough, and that is that the first two digital revolutions, as you describe in the book, created, because we didn't manage them perhaps in the smartest way, created inequities, certain inequities. So those are those are challenges we have to face right now. Does this third digital revolution perhaps could it have the negative consequences of creating a negative feedback loop that even makes even more inequities? And I'm thinking just at the sort of a rudimentary example, like schools, elementary schools now that are able to afford creating makerspaces versus those schools that cannot, because there's already inequities built in.
So let me give you an example. You're absolutely right that a deeper digital divide is one of the risks that we face. But let's take the region Pittsburgh. It was a steel town that fell on hard times. About 10 years ago, there was a series of pancake breakfasts that educators said kids aren't learning the way they used to. And they started focusing on project-based learning. One breakfast led to another. It led to 17. Today, 10 years later, there's 2,000 educators, about 200 makerspaces and fab labs, and they're really reinventing learning for that whole region. And it's become a center for robotics that's tied to Carnegie Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh. But it starts in the elementary schools, the middle schools, and the high schools, in which they're saying, leave nobody out.
To pick up on two reasons why we wrote the book to have that discussion, but why it's reasonable to be optimistic. One is fab labs can now make fab labs. So rather than being limited than buying one, the technology really is growing to be able to spread virally. And in turn with them, they're being used today to make food, furniture, all the sorts of things you consume. There's a Fab City movement that Boston, Somerville, and Cambridge joined of cities committing to a countdown to producing what they consume locally. And so rather than sort of big companies far away doing mysterious things that lead to inequality, they're being used for the sort of meeting local needs. And that's why this one is so different, because think of it as what we're doing is we're taking the digital world, but we're sort of bringing it out here into the physical world.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm coming around to your way of thinking, but I do wonder, though, haven't we seen in the past that anytime exciting new distributive kinds of technologies, at first it does seem like it's going to bring so much more into the realm of individual or local control and creation. That's what it seems like at first. But inevitably, governments and corporations somehow end up consolidating what was once distributed. And so, why won't that happen in this case?
So on the one hand, we don't want to paint government and corporations all with the same paintbrush. There are plenty of companies and plenty of government leaders who are genuinely motivated by double bottom lines and so on. So there's plenty of room for public-private partnership and for innovation that involves the private sector as well as the public sector. But you're absolutely right that we have not done a good job of building in the institutions that co-evolve with technology the first two times around. And there's a lot of work to be done to not have it come up short as it could. So your skepticism is well placed, and we have a lot of work to do.
But the part I think you're not right about, again, what's different is a user of Facebook doesn't have much control over what Facebook does. Mm-hmm. There aren't easy points of control here. I've been in rooms with the military heads and the intelligence heads where half of the room wants to control it, and the other half points out what I would say, which is there aren't points of control. You can help shape it, but there isn't a bottleneck for somebody from above to take it away. Again, go back to this image of fab labs making fab labs, local production. There aren't sort of points of control for central authority over it.
Okay.
I'll reinforce what Neil's saying. Again, we have entered this project to say, can we make sure that we take into account all of these social challenges? But if you look at the ecosystem of fab labs, people are sharing designs independent of trying to protect intellectual property. They're sharing the underlying principles of the materials they use, which is often a closely guarded secret in industry. So there's a sense of openness and sharing. It could be shut down by certain forces, but right now it's getting out faster and, in a sense, seeping through cracks in the system and creating some norms that allow for that local control.
We have just a couple of seconds left, less than a minute, actually, but I want to get one more question into you, because it seems like as if this fabrication revolution really requires internet infrastructure. But Speaking of the now, again, we just have a couple of seconds, you know, the FCC has this different stance on net neutrality. What effect might that have?
So again, this doesn't replace, it merges communication computation with fabrication. Okay. One of the most interesting projects is people making their own internets, bypassing the FCC.
We'll have to have you back to talk about that. Well, we just scratched the surface here, but it's an absolutely fascinating book. The book is called Designing Reality: How to Survive and Thrive in the Third Digital Revolution. It's by Neil Gershenfeld, Alan Gershenfeld, and Joel Kutcher Gershenfeld. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Indeed, a pleasure.
Our pleasure.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.